Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Jen Wilkin, with reflections on life and the loss of her mother.
Even if you have a terrible relationship with your parent, really a lot of it for you is being able to say when that parent has passed on, I did what I could. You know, as far as I knew, the good that I could do, I did it. And to be able to stand before the Lord and say that with your hands open, that's no small matter.
Jen Wilkin next. Aging is something our culture often resists. We fight against wrinkles, loss of independence, and the changes that come with time. But what if aging isn't something to fear, but something to lean into with wisdom and grace? In her article for Christianity Today, Jen Wilkin, a gifted Bible teacher, reflects on the beauty of life's patterned order, the symmetry woven into our existence, and what it means to embrace each season, including the later ones, with gratitude rather than resistance. Today, she and Sunny explore how recognizing these rhythms can shape the way we live, how aging invites us to release self-reliance, and how women can begin to see this transition not as a loss, but as a sacred gift.
Jen, as we get started today, what prompted you to write this article?
I think, you know, clearly from what the article covers, you can tell that grief prompted me to start thinking about these things. My mother is the first person close to me that I ever lost. So what a charmed life I have led to not lose someone close to me until I was, almost 54 years old, 53 years old. But beyond that, I think it's a conversation that we have to start having with a younger generation. We live in a day and age where aging is something that is to be pushed away and to be denied. You know, I mean, the current phrase you hear a lot now is, oh, so-and-so is aging backward, as though that's something to be desired. And so I think what I wanted to do is to start exploring how actually aging forward is not only the way that God has ordained for things to go, but it's desirable. There are desirable things about it, and it comes with its own responsibilities as well.
Now, you introduced the idea of a chiasm in your article,
yes,
something that many listeners may not be familiar with. So could you unpack what that means and maybe give us an example and share why you think it's significant in understanding this topic?
Yeah, so a chiasm is a form of parallelism that the ancient Near Eastern mind, so the writers of the Old Testament, but beyond those writers, the ancient Near Eastern writers in general loved. And it's unlike how we think about Western ideas of parallelism. Like, we tend to think of two statements that say the same thing right next to each other. And those forms of parallelism do exist in the Bible, especially in the wisdom writings. But a chiasm sort of has bookends that then work inwardly toward a main point that falls in the middle. So probably one of the most overlooked but most obvious chiasms that people would be familiar with the writing would be Psalm 139, where it starts with, Lord, you have searched me and known me, and it ends with, search me, O God, and know me. So like, those are the bookends. You hear the same idea twice. And a lot of times it's same but different. There's a slightly different twist on the second time you see the idea presented. And then you can trace the ideas inward to the middle of the psalm. And the middle of the psalm in that case would be, wonderful are your works, O Lord, my soul knows this full well. A shorter version of a chiasm would be, if we fail to plan, we plan to fail. So that would be a very short, pithy sort of inversion that doesn't have a central point, but shows that kind of parallelism. So it's kind of, people initially hear it and they're like, I don't care about this. But once you begin to realize that they're everywhere and that you can miss the main emphasis of what something is saying if you're not looking at them, then they grow in interest for it. Like, there are some scholars who would say that the entire first five books of the Bible form a chiasm. There are some who would say the Bible as a whole forms a chiasm, but it gives the sense of a full circle story, that it starts somewhere and it ends somewhere very similar. So again, thinking about that as it relates to life and aging, and thought, wow, we have some very well delineated and similar bookends to life Maybe there's more there. Maybe there are other places. If we traced it inward, we could see other patterns to communicate how things are same but different in different stages of life.
Now, if somebody is having their interest, you know, peaked right now, they're like, I'm curious about this. How would you encourage somebody as they're looking at scripture to look for these patterns? Like, where do they start?
Well, anytime you're reading along and you hear something repeated and you're like, wait, what? Didn't we already say that? You know, where you're like, why are they saying the same thing again? There's usually a pretty good indication that this pattern is occurring. And so I would just encourage you, if you see two similar things that have a little bit of distance between them, then start asking if you can find a way to trace inward toward a central point. And there are actually a lot of online accounts. It's kind of cool where people submit their nerdy ideas about where chiasms are or aren't. And there's not always complete agreement on how the pattern plays out. But I think when it comes to this question we're looking at about the pattern of life, I mean, it occurred to me that God in his kindness might have done this for us so that we can have a sense of how things will play out for us in a fallen world where death is coming for us, where physical death is coming for us, so that we might obey the words of Psalm 90, that we should number our days to gain a heart of wisdom, that we can keep track of where we are in the sequence of things. And I think a lot of people recognize the bookends of life. That's a pretty clear thing in scriptures. We have Job saying, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I shall return. That's a chiastic structure. We often say in the liturgies associated with funerals, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, this understanding that this is a full circle story. And so I think that we can be helped in numbering our days with wisdom when we pay attention to how those bookends might be pointing to other parallels that are useful to us as we navigate life.
Now, when you think of, I remember your article talking about we tend to view it as the human, like the arc of our lives.
Yes. Yeah.
And yet if we're to look at it in the way that you're encouraging us, what does that say of midlife, right? Because if you're telling us to go back to the middle, I have some curiosity around that.
Yeah. So I think the misunderstanding might be, oh, well, then are you saying that midlife must be the most significant time of our lives, or it's the main point of being alive? And so if you're thinking about midlife, you're thinking about how you're looking back over how you got here, and then you're looking forward to how you're going to exit. And if we have better understanding about how we came to the middle of life, then we are better equipped to walk out the second half. So for example, if we paid attention to how when we were toddlers, we were gaining personal freedoms and we were gaining autonomy and life was filled with potentialities, then it makes more sense when we reach that other consensus circle at the other side or that other concentric layer that we would expect and not be surprised by that we would be relinquishing personal freedoms, losing some of the autonomy that we have, and walking into a stage where not only is it going to come for us, but that it's appropriate for it to come to us. Because I think, you know, we rail against some of these changes that come, and I understand why. I certainly want to maintain the autonomy of adulthood, you know, for as long as is reasonably possible. But I think when we don't see that as what's next, when we see it as something that we can either not think about, which is very common in our culture, is we stop wanting to think about anything aging related. You know, you hit midlife and you think it's a journey into obsolescence and invisibility. But what if we had visibility on what was going to come next because we'd paid attention to how we got here? So I think midlife is a moment where not it's the most significant time of life, but it's a time where we have a vantage point that can help us if we're oriented to what came before, to be oriented to what is yet to come.
It seems like in our culture right now, there's almost like an obsession with this middle age. You know, you constantly see everywhere the perimenopause, menopause conversations, right? That are like
so depressing. My algorithm on Instagram, and you know, like, why are you showing me these ads? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we have this obsession, but also it's very common that a person would have what we call a midlife crisis.
Absolutely.
And so for somebody who's listening to you right now, who is really carrying that sense of, I'm having a midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. I am on the struggle bus right now. With this idea that you're suggesting for us, what would you say to that person right now about how they could, what maybe questions they could be asking themselves or ways that they could be looking at it? What would you say?
Well, first of all, I think it's normal. I mean, I think, you know, there's all this conversation about deconstruction happening right now in the church, and I think it's really healthy to talk about those things. But I think the midlife crisis, as cringy as it may sound to us, is its own form of deconstruction. It's where you're deconstructing and hopefully reconstructing how you're thinking about life. It is appropriate at midlife to ask really important questions about what you're going to do with the time that's left. And I think that's essentially what a midlife crisis boils down to, because midlife is where the ways that we think about contribution begin to shift. We know we have limited time left where we might be producing something, like in the sense of our jobs. We begin to move from sort of innovating and thinking, you know, of limitless timelines to thinking of, wait, how am I going to conserve and how am I going to maximize the accrued knowledge and experience that I have? There's a really good book by Arthur Brooks called From Strength to Strength, where he talks about moving from the fluid learning curve to the crystallized learning curve in life. That's really helpful to kind of think through why we even have a midlife crisis, because we can feel that we're not going to be able to contribute to conversations the way that we did when we were younger. But there is still a lot of good left in the way that we can enter into conversations and be a part of people's lives. It just might not look like it always has. So I think when you're looking with the whole span of life in view, and when you have people who are older than you who have walked with wisdom through those later stages, you're at a great advantage to those who are simply thinking, how can I conserve the first half of the chiasm because I have no constructive vision for the second half?
It's beautiful. It makes me just, you know, you think of the word crisis, and sometimes we want to resist that of, oh no, here I am in midlife crisis. But what you're describing here is it's an invitation and it's a leaning into that, what we call crisis.
Absolutely. It's happening for a reason.
Yes. So I love that. Now in your article, you beautifully describe the symmetry and chiasm of human life. You've shared about the experience of losing your mother and wrote of her final exhale. You said, and it hit me, the marvelous and terrible symmetry of a long human life. Would you elaborate on this for our listeners today?
Yeah, I'm going to try not to cry, as I got to get better at talking about this without crying. Yeah, I think that anyone who has held the hand of a loved one who had the gift of living a long life, anyone who has seen them out, so to speak, can pretty readily connect the similarities between birth and death. You know, in the article, I talk about how the hospice nurse said, you know, you can coach her. You can coach her through this. And there was the labored breathing. I mean, there were so many similarities to the moment of birth, and then same but different, you know, as I mentioned, is common in chiastic forms. It was same but different. She was not going to move toward anything. Toward anything in this life. She was moving toward this final stage, but it was very much a labor. And a labor through which she could be coached. And then there was the final exhale and a crashing silence. And I thought of the labor and delivery moment where there is this giant inhale and then that wail that tells you that life has arrived. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have seen that moment, that very sacred moment, and made that connection. But then I began to think, what about all of the other connections? I mean, it was only about 4 months ago that my son put on the family text thread, baby Jeffrey. So he was the youngest grandchild at the time. Baby Jeffrey he's walking like a pro, like he hardly falls at all anymore. And literally the next text I got was from my stepmother saying, your dad fell again.
Oh,
and this is what's happening, right? Here I am in the middle, and I'm watching how these two stages of life are so similar, you know, the kinds of food that are eaten by baby Jeffrey and my dad are similar, because both of them are dealing with dental challenges that you don't have, you know, further on in life. And the sheer number of ways in which we can find comparisons, you know, there's caregiving downward toward children, and then there's caregiving upward toward aging parents. And so I just tend to think there's some wisdom that we're missing in a culture that has embraced the idea that that the elderly in particular are a problem. Like, that was what my mother, I noted this in the article, my mother would always say, I'm so sorry, you have to take me to the doctor, I'm so sorry, you know, and I would say, you're a person to love, not a problem to solve. And can I just be honest, like, sometimes it felt like a problem to solve. I was having to remind myself, you know, this is a person to love and not a problem to solve. But not only do the generation of caregivers perceive that aging parents are a problem they shouldn't have to deal with, often the parents themselves, because of the generations in which they grew up with, regard themselves as a problem their children should not have to solve, in a way that we would never think of a newborn. Like, you would never say of a newborn, ugh, you're such an inconvenience to me. Mm. Like, I had plans today and now I have to deal with you. But we can tend to think about the elderly as a burden, and they think of themselves as a burden because the potentiality is not there. They're not becoming a contributor. They're going to contribute less and less in the ways that we tend to value in our culture as the days pass. So I think when we understand, no, actually those forms of caregiving are very similar, and a whole life pro-life ethic means that we value caregiving for the elderly in much the same terms that we do caregiving for a newborn. Same but different, right? An elderly person is not a child. They are an adult, so it's same but different. But it can help us to think differently about how we're going to allocate our time, even how we're going to live geographically in relation to extended family. I think there are massive implications.
Yeah. That statement that you made is so powerful for someone who's wrestling with feeling like a burden in this season of, you are not a problem to solve. Mm-hmm. You're a person to love. Mm-hmm. And you said that you had to make that statement multiple times, probably both, yes, for yourself and for her.
Yes.
What did that help shift for you as the caregiver?
Mm-hmm. My motives. You know, I think that when I would picture my mother holding me as a small child and not counting the cost, then I want to hold her as an aging parent and not count the cost. It doesn't mean that it's not costly. It just means that you reevaluate how you think about that cost. And, you know, I said this in the article and I want to say it here as well. Don't idealize my relationship with my mother. It was not always an easy relationship. And I think that's true of most of us. And what I'm also not saying is that there's no room for, you know, caregiving that is paid for or something like that. But our whole attitude toward the elderly is they're a financial conundrum to figure out. Like, how are we going to pay for this? And how are we going to, like, maintain boundaries? And those are not things that we don't consider, but it shifts when you begin to think, this is a person in front of me who is enduring great loss. Like, really, the aging is great loss. Like, I think about the words that Job says after he says, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I shall return. The next thing he says is, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Aging is a process of the Lord taking away some things. And so when we can stand beside the person who's in that phase of life and say, I'm actually next, like, it won't be very long before I'm the one who's handing back a lot of things. How do I want to be treated at that time? How can I do my best to meet this aging parent? Or maybe it's not even your parent. Maybe it's someone who's in your church community. Like, one of the things that's really risen to the surface for me in all of this is that whereas we have a top of mind awareness of an orphan problem at the beginning of life and the church's ability to help with that, we have a lot of functional elderly orphans in our communities and churches. Mm-hmm. Do we place dignity on that need as we might for the other end of the side of the chiasm? So these are just, it's all stuff that's still bubbling around in my thoughts.
Yeah. And that, your statement of, I have to keep going there because it's so powerful in the, you are not a problem to solve, you're mm-hmm. a person to love. Mm-hmm. How would you encourage somebody who needs to hear that in this moment?
It's okay if you say it before you feel it. Mm-hmm. I think of it as a liturgy, really. And it's say it to yourself before you say it to the person who you might be thinking it about. But I know for my mom, I don't think she ever fully believed it was true. Mm-hmm. But it meant so much to her that was where we were coming from. And then we didn't just say it, we showed it. You know, we tried to to be there. And I'm talking, it was a family effort. I'm grateful for a family, you know, that is all hands on deck for those kinds of moments. But it was grandkids, and it was my husband, and it was, you know, everyone saying, hey, we love you. We, there are problems to solve. There are things about this that are going to be hard, but it's not you alone trying to navigate them. It's all of us pulling together for you. And these are things that are evident in cultures that are more collectivist and cultures that understand extended family in ways that our culture moved away from in the 50s and 60s, frankly. But for the individual who is feeling guilty because they don't feel it, it's okay if you don't feel it. I can say that once you start to act from that perspective, the feelings actually come. Like, even if you have a terrible relationship with your parent, really, a lot of it for you is being able to say, when that parent has passed on, I did what I could. You know, as far as I knew, the good that I could do, I did it. And to be able to stand before the Lord and say that with your hands open, that's no small matter.
I just think that it's such a powerful statement that sometimes we view from the, you know, like I maybe as a burden want to hear that statement, but to hear you when you were describing it from the coaching position, like that was, I love, thank you for taking time on that. Cause I think you formed that really beautiful for people. So how does this perspective of, I'm going to ask this one. So how might remembering that seasons of life follow a patterned order help us to embrace, or as you mentioned in your article, inhabit the season that we are in and wisely steward the time that we've been given?
I think there are a couple of ways to think about it. I think one that we would be remiss not to mention is that when you know someone for whom the pattern did not hold, so maybe it's infant loss, or even miscarriage. You know, maybe it is someone who died as a teenager or as a child, people who don't get the full arc of the chiasm. When we recognize that not everyone receives 70 or 80 years, you know, to take from Moses in Psalm 90, then I think it changes our perspective on the years that we have. I hope it does. I hope it causes us to value them because as long as we are alive, we're still in a position, first of all, to honor the brevity of those lives by the way that we live our own lives, but also to think about contribution beyond self-actualization. I think that we think about a full life as being I self-actualized. And I don't want to completely throw that idea out because I do think that that's a byproduct of sanctification. I do think you become your truest self the more that you're conformed to the image of Christ. But as we look on the reason it's so painful when someone dies what we would call an early age is because we know that there was another step and another step beyond that. There should have been a rise and a decline. We intuitively know the shape that life typically takes. So I think we can value those who don't receive the gift of that in the way that we live in the current space that we find ourselves. But I think that we also are better at not being in a hurry, particularly in the younger years of life. I think a marker of like being in your early 20s or even your 30s is I can't wait until fill in the blank. And you can. Like, I think that's one of the benefits of having regular contact with a mentor or a parent who's older than you, whom you respect, is they can say, hey, slow down. You know, go ahead and just make sure that you've lived this day well. Like, you're not meant to inhabit the future. So don't let your mind go there any more than makes sense for good planning purposes. But really cherish this moment that you have. Now, on the other side, I think there's the problem of saying, I just wish I could be 20 or 30 again, you know, once you're over the hill, as the saying goes. And that too is a misunderstanding of the preciousness of our days, that you're not numbering your days if you're constantly yearning either for what's to come or for what used to be. And you're also probably romanticizing both directions when you do that. But just certainly just, you know, sufficient unto the day is the trouble thereof is a good watchword for us. It's like, if I can live this day well and hold the future open-handedly and hold the past with clear-sightedness, then maybe I'll be able to truly be present in the present the way that human beings are built to be. And then, and have what, you know, I mean, what rarer form of contentment is there than to be content with the phase of life that you're in? We talk about contentment in terms of our physical possessions all the time, but I think that that aspect of it, to be just simply content to be where you are and to recognize I'm growing in wisdom in some ways that I don't have yet. I'm not liable for wisdom I don't have yet. And I'm not liable to have more energy than is appropriate to the age that I am. And the Lord knows my stage of life and my situation perfectly. I'm the one who has imperfect knowledge of them. And so to have a right expectation and a right hope for the phase that you're in.
If you were to go deeper on that idea, what does it look like to embrace contentment with the season and the day that you are in?
Can I talk specifically to the women at this point?
Absolutely.
I think it's hard to, let's talk about like the daily liturgies of the woman who is moving into middle age. We have women in their 20s who are being told that they need to be taking steps to avoid their faces ever aging. And it's so fascinating to me because, your 20s are probably the only decade in which you shouldn't have to think about that at all. Like, it shouldn't even pass through your minds, you know. But when the average age of the influencer on TikTok is 18 to 24, it's no wonder that women in their 20s are feeling enormous pressure to start thinking about preventative things to do to make sure that they never wrinkle or sag. And I wonder how good we are at numbering our days properly when the face we see in the mirror every morning wants to lie to us about the passage of time. And so I'm constantly asked, you know, well, what can I do? What can't I do? You know, can I dye my hair and all that? And I'm like, I'm actually not in the business of telling you what you can and can't do. I'm in the business of asking you to look inward. And ask what's driving those feelings that you're having, to think harder than the culture will ever ask you to think about the decisions that you're making. And some of that is to think harder about the other people who are walking through the chiasm right behind you, the small people in your home, the people in your circle of influence. How are you setting an example for them of how to number their days aright? And so it's tough. You know, it's the messaging all around us is that the older you look, the less relevant you are. And I actually think that that is true within our culture. The older you look, the less relevant you are. But as Christian women in a subculture that we would call the church, it must not be so among us. We're the ones who are supposed to see gray hair, and I'm not saying literal, go ahead and dye your hair, guys, that gray hair is a crown of glory. Why? Because it shows that you have years of experience that are of value to those around you. And so whether it's, you know, the color of your hair or just the way that you inhabit the relationships that the Lord has given you, where you have influence and you say, you know what, it's okay if no one checks me out at a stoplight, because I have important business to be about. And in many ways, that process of becoming invisible is one of the most freeing things that can happen to a Christian woman. It strips away all of the things that were less important and helps her dig deep and say, what really matters in this life?
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, author and Bible teacher Jen Wilkin. You can read her piece, At My Mother's Deathbed, I Discovered the Cemetery of a Long Life, by going to ChristianityToday.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at the same time for another edition of His People.